This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. Let's start 2026 with a hard truth. There's no perfect time to build the future you secretly dream of, and there's no time to waste. With support from a Talkspace therapist, you can make this the year you bravely go out and grab what you need from life, whether that's outer rewards or inner peace. Just go to Talkspace.com to be matched with a licensed online therapist. You can start messaging with your therapist right away and schedule live virtual sessions over video, audio, or chat. Your Talkspace therapist can help you create personalized strategies for making the changes and achieving the goals most important to you. Talkspace accepts most insurance with an average copay of $15, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com and save $80 with code SPACE80. That's SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Ever feel like planning a trip is almost as fun as taking it? Hotel comparisons, restaurant reservations, a perfectly timed itinerary. What if your love of planning travel could actually become a source of income? As a Fora advisor, it can. Fora is a modern travel agency built for people who love to plan travel and help others travel well. With best-in-class training, powerful booking tech, and a vibrant global community of experts sharing real insider knowledge, you can confidently build your own travel business on your terms, from anywhere. Every hotel, cruise, and experience you book earns you commission. And with access to more than 7,000 preferred travel partners from iconic brands to boutique gems, you'll unlock VIP perks like upgrades, resort credits, and late checkout. The kind of elevated travel experiences most travelers never get. Now's the time to turn your passion for travel into a fulfilling business with Fora. Become a Fora advisor today at foratravel.com/advisor. That's foratravel.com/advisor.
She had been sexually assaulted and stabbed 45 times.
45 stab wounds. That is absolute overkill. It also tells you this wasn't like a quick, efficient murder. This was some sort of rage.
It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
My name's Ed, and for the past 2 decades, I've been producing true crime content for some of your favorite networks like Hulu, Oxygen, and of course, Investigation Discovery.
And I'm Melissa, Ed's bestie and walking, talking true crime database.
We've combined my behind-the-scenes insight with Melissa's morbid curiosity to bring you a podcast that immerses you in the true crime genre like never before.
We highlight victims' cases and bring you exclusive insight from the people who lived through them, with a touch of humor to lighten even the darkest stories.
This is Murder Unscripted.
Dun, dun, dun.
Happy New Year, crime crew. Welcome to episode 85 of Murder Unscripted, still the internet's most immersive true crime podcast. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, along with a woman who has held on to the title of bestie for another year, Melissa Spivey.
Whoop, whoop. You hear that, Jay? Suck it.
Well, first things first, Melissa and I are absolutely thrilled to be back with you in 2026. 2025 was a roller coaster as we grew a lot as a podcast, I think, and as hosts, honestly. We retuned our tone a little bit, our format, and we think we're really hitting our stride. So I am so excited to continue bringing you new cases, new guests, new perspectives, and we can't thank you all enough for being along for the ride. We are pumped.
Yeah, we really are. This is exciting. I think 2026, I'm not big into being like, oh, this is my year, because I think you set yourself up for failure.
Yeah.
But I think at least Murder Unscripted-wise, it's going to be a good year.
I do too.
Well, to kick off 2026, we have a new theme, new block. You know how it goes.
Do I go and whoop this whoop month, now? If you announce it, do I go whoop whoop?
I think you should, because I usually do that.
That's as whoopy as I get.
Anyway, so this month, we're dedicating this entire block to cases involving exonerations, which we're calling fresh starts. Kind of a nod to New Year's resolutions.
Ah, yes. All the gym memberships that skyrocket and then at least until February. But go on.
I feel like it's like crazy crowded. And then February, you just see like tumbleweeds rolling past like the doors of Planet Fitness. Well, the stories we're going to cover involve cases where the justice system got it wrong and sometimes horrifically wrong. And innocent people paid the price with years, sometimes decades of their lives.
Right.
And We're not going to reveal it just yet, but we have a super cool guest lined up for this month. It's actually someone who has close ties to Ed and his career.
That is a fact, and you guys are going to love him, and that is the clue you're getting, that it's a him.
You're welcome.
Yeah, good luck.
Well, before we dive into today's case, I think it's really important to set the stage with some statistics, because when you hear these numbers, it really drives home just how broken parts of our justice system can be. According to the National Registry of Exonerations, which is run as a consortium between the University of Michigan Law School, the Michigan State University College of Law, and UC Irvine, and since 1989, more than 3,400 people have been exonerated in the United States after being wrongly convicted of crimes that they did not commit.
Wow, 3,400 people.
Yes. Wow. Isn't that wild?
Crazy stats.
Collectively, these innocent people have lost over 31,000 years to wrongful imprisonment.
Unreal.
That's an average of about 11 to 14 years per exoneree.
Can you imagine? Like, you're in your 20s and you have your whole life ahead of you, and something like this happens, and you wake up one day and you're middle-aged, you've spent your half of your life behind bars. It's a whole new world out there when you get out.
Well, and you missed all that time. You only have one life and you just missed it. Well, according to the Innocence Project, somewhere between 2% and 10% of people who are currently incarcerated in the United States prisons are actually innocent. And when you do the math on like our prison population, it's a little over about 2 million people. That means anywhere from 46,000 to 230,000 innocent people could be behind bars right now.
That is insane. And it's funny you say that, because Santa, we were doing stuff like that with statistics. We were joking about the amount of the toys, Melissa, right? But 2%, when it's such a large number to begin with, 2% is a lot.
Well, in addition to the statistics, let's also talk about why these wrongful convictions happen, because it's not usually like just one thing. It's kind of a perfect storm of failures. So according to the most recent annual report from the National Registry of Exonerations, official misconduct is present in the majority of wrongful conviction cases. And we're talking about things like falsifying evidence, coercing witnesses, and withholding information that could help the defendant.
Yep.
Other major factors include eyewitness misidentification, which that accounts for over 60% of wrongful convictions. Isn't that wild?
Wow.
And then you've got false confessions, which is about 29% of cases. And then perjury or false accusations show up in roughly 70% of cases.
That, I believe. I was surprised about the 29% and the false accusations. I would have actually thought, or false confession, sorry, I would have thought that would have been less. Like, I don't.
Really? I thought it would have been higher.
Huh.
Maybe not so much anymore.
That's what I'm saying. I think, yeah,
that's true. Well, on top of all of that, there's also, you know, just having inadequate legal defense. And there's also what they call junk science, which is forensic evidence that seems reliable at the time, but has since been debunked. And there's several things.
The case that we're going to be featuring, like that has our featured guest at the end of the month, is something like that. We're going to get into forensic odontology, which is the teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of debunked.
Yeah. I think handwriting analysis is kind of being looked at like,
That's another one.
Well, one of the most troubling factors is informant testimony, which, like, you know, that's when someone who's facing their own charges agree to testify against a defendant in exchange for a lighter sentence or like some other kind of benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the Innocence Project, informants have played a role in more than 15% of wrongful conviction cases that were later overturned through DNA testing.
Wow. I'm actually surprised that's not higher, because I do feel like every person who's incarcerated is trying to cut a deal to better their own situation. So they're going to say anything. So 15% seems so low.
It's so stupid that they even consider that.
They are definitely, the statistics are so staggering, though. And it's the main reason that we thought it would be great to kind of dig into some of these cases that You can hear not only what it did to these victims' families, but also the person who is allegedly responsible. It's heartbreaking stuff, so let's get into it. This is the story of Carol Elaine Armstrong and the wrongful conviction of Randolph Arledge. And I do want to add that this case also shows us that exoneration isn't just about freeing an innocent person. It's about the victim's family, too. So for over 30 years, Carol's family believed that her killer was behind bars. And then they found out he wasn't, that the real killer was still out there, which is a whole different kind of trauma.
That's something I can't even begin to comprehend.
Yeah. Having that rug ripped out from under you like that?
Yeah. Oh, wait, before we dive in, quick reminder to please like, rate, review, subscribe, all the things. It really does help the show.
Absolutely, it does. With that, let's head to rural Texas in the summer of 1981, specifically Navarro County. And before we get into the gruesome details of what happened that morning, I do want to take a minute to paint a picture of Navarro County for you, because I feel like understanding this place really helps you understand the case. So Navarro County, it has an incredibly rich history. It was formed in 1846 and named after Jose Antonio Navarro, who was one of only two native-born Texans to sign the Texas Declaration of Independence. And the county seat, which is Corsicana, which is kind of where the story takes place, was founded in 1848 and named after the Mediterranean island of Corsica, which we've all heard of. Mm-hmm. And that was the birthplace, actually, of Navarro's father, the guy who founded Navarro County. And here's the thing that really put Corsicana on the map. So in 1894, drillers were searching for water for the city, basically drinking water, when they accidentally struck oil at 1,035 feet. And that accidental discovery made Corsicana the site of the first commercially significant oil field in Texas. Crazy, right?
Damn.
Well, by 1900, there were over 600 producing wells within the city limit, and Corsicana became one of the wealthiest towns in Texas. And Melissa, I know you're a fan of celebrities, and like, that's how you tie in like what people look like, hey, which put places on the map. Unfortunately, there are not too many kind of notable names that have come out of Navarro County or Corsicana, but I did find a few people who you probably won't know. But 1940s,
okay, fair.
1940s Texas Governor Buford Jester, country music legends Lefty Frizzell and Billy Joe Shaver, and the jazz saxophonist David Fathead Newman, who he played with Ray Charles. So he also hailed from Corsicana.
I totally know Billy Joe Shaver.
Oh, you don't have a Fathead Newman CD in your car?
I do not.
Well, by 1981, when our story takes place, the oil boom days were long gone, and Corsicana's population was around 22,000, which honestly, today it's only around 25,000, so hasn't grown a whole lot since those days. Manufacturing and farming jobs are prominent, and since it's only about 50 miles from Dallas, there are people in Corsicana, they felt those big city vibes while also being far enough away to maintain that really small-town Texas feel, which I think is the best
really
of both
nice.
Worlds.
That's really nice. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, this really was the prototypical kind of everyone knows everyone, nobody locks their doors type of town, and that's important because violent crime, especially something as brutal as what we're about to describe, was almost unheard of. Because again, this wasn't Dallas. It wasn't Houston. This was a town where the biggest news was a high school football game and the annual Derrick Days festival. And I'm talking about Derrick like an oil Derrick celebrating those glory days.
I was honestly hoping it was like a festival for dudes named Derrick.
Oh my God, what a great festival.
This sounds great.
I swear to God, I've seen those on TikTok and stuff. It's like the meeting of the Daves or something. It's a party with 100 Daves. Well, I'm sure you're kind of getting the sense that when a body is found on this desolate dirt road off South Highway 22, it rocked this community to its core.
Wow.
So it's Sunday, August 30th, and we're in Navarro County, Texas, which is about 50 miles southeast of Dallas. So it's early morning, about 9 a.m., and a local woman is out on this dirt road off, I mentioned, South Highway 22, checking on her livestock. And there on the side of the road is a partially nude body of a young woman. And kind of generally speaking, she was naked from the waist down, and her body was riddled with stab wounds. And the woman immediately calls the authorities.
Oh my God, what a horrible thing to stumble upon. Like, you're just out there going about your morning routine.
Feeding your chickens.
And all of a sudden, you see, and I'm sure the first thing in her brain was, is that a mannequin? Because we know that's what everybody always thinks, but
Yeah, you don't want to think that's a person. Jesus.
Right, of course.
Well, Navarro County Sheriff Bobby Ross and his deputies, they arrive on the scene, and what they find is absolutely brutal. So the victim was a young woman. She was clearly in her early 20s, late teens, so maybe 19, 20, 21, 22, in that range. And she had been sexually assaulted and stabbed 40, 45 times in the chest and neck area.
45 stab wounds. That is absolute overkill.
Like, yeah,
that tells you something about the killer. And it also tells you this wasn't like a quick, efficient murder. This was some sort of rage. And
right.
Stabbing usually, not always, but it can indicate that it's personal.
This is a level of overkill that makes no sense when you just see this body laying here. Like, I would first think that this was a domestic situation and that's where she was dumped. Mm-hmm.
Well, the other thing I was thinking, it could be someone who has some kind of like, gets a sick pleasure out of like the act itself.
Yeah. And there's plenty of those guys running around.
Sick.
Especially in Texas in the 80s.
Yeah, right?
Well, deputies are quickly able to identify this victim, and it's 21-year-old Carol Elaine Armstrong, and she had just celebrated her 21st birthday less than a week earlier.
Wow.
So, and here I'm going to vent a little bit, and it's not directed at any one person in particular. I want to say that when I picked this case and started researching, I was absolutely blown away by the lack of information on this girl. And like we're talking not a single photo online, and thanks to our lovely research producer, Shannon, we did learn that she was literally one of the most popular girls in town, at least in her school. And I don't understand how on earth there cannot be like any mention of the incredible things that she did in any of these articles.
Yeah, I looked and it was all the same information, very little information, but the same right. information, just like mm-hmm. over and over again.
Yeah, and nothing about her. But what I will say is thanks to Shannon, she found her 1977 and 1978 yearbooks, and Ooh. There were some little pictures of Carol being involved in all of these awesome activities, and then a little blurb under the photo, which is how we learned the little bit about her backstory that we did is from these yearbook photos. So thank God Shannon came up with this, because this poor girl now has some kind of identity, and I am thrilled to say that this might be the first podcast that's ever covered this case and bringing the story to light. So once again, we will be the model on how information on Carol Armstrong is presented in the future.
And I'm just so glad that we're saying her name.
Yes.
So she's not forgotten.
Yeah, because clearly the media didn't say it more than 5 times over the past 50 years. All that being said, I am going to tell you what we were able to find about the incredible 21-year-old Carol Elaine Armstrong. So Carol hailed from Blooming Grove, which is a tiny town of just a few hundred people, and it's about 10 miles south of Corsicana. And she was born on August 24th, 1960, to parents Jack Gilbert Armstrong and Helen Maxine Hyler. And she had at least 2 siblings that we can confirm. There was Gary and Jackie. There may have been more. I don't want to speak out of turn, though, because that could also be it. Mm-hmm. And I even picked through the find-a-graves for Jack and Helen, the parents, and found one picture of Jack. Like, none of Helen whatsoever. It's, like, just sad. This was just a sad one to research. And luckily, Jack's page did have a little blurb about his life. And I know this case isn't about him, but I wanted to share that with you. So,
So
Jack was born in Navarro County, Texas, to the late Solomon and Mamie Armstrong. And he was in the United States Navy, serving in Iwo Jima and in Guam. And Jack was a member of the Lions Club. He'd served on the Blooming Grove School Board and was also a member of the Blooming Grove Volunteer Fire Department when it first started.
He was busy.
He was busy. And Jack enjoyed taking care of his cows, and he was very active. In fact, he enjoyed dancing up until 2016, when he passed at the ripe old age of 89. Aww. And he is currently buried in Rose Hill Cemetery in Navarro County. Wow. And regarding Carol, his daughter, so this girl was literally involved in everything at Blooming Grove High School. So in 1977, she was a junior. Similar to the girls that we covered before, Sarah Yarbrough and Shannon Siders, I'm literally going to list the 4,372 things that Carol was a member of while she was in high school.
And Mandy Stavick. And the yogurt shop girls. We've covered so many victims who have done more in their short time on this earth than I've done in 37 years.
That's absolutely right. And they're the worst kind of stories to tell because of all the promise they had.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she was on the basketball team. She was on the volleyball team. She was also a cheerleader. And I'm not just talking about any cheerleader. So I think between 1977 and 1978, I probably saw her in 10 photographs. She was on top of a pyramid. She was on the bottom of a pyramid. She was holding pom-poms. She was in a group shot with her friends. She was holding a megaphone. And this was the days when all the girls had these cool, they had their names written on their shirts and on their megaphones, which I think is just a really fun sign of the times. But I definitely got the sense that Carol, cheering was her thing. And she was obviously present at every sporting event, cheering on her beloved Blooming Grove Lions. She was a member of the FHA, which is basically the Future Leaders of America. She was on student council. She was a former homecoming queen nominee and also voted senior class favorite in 1978.
Aww.
So, and there's this cute picture in the yearbook too. And this was kind of weird to me. So in 1976, her mom was also voted homecoming queen. And I don't really know what to make of that information. There's a picture of her. I don't know if it was some kind of like special where they invite the moms, because I think it was called like homegoing queen.
Oh, okay.
Interesting. But it was kind of cool to see. So it showed me that mom was really involved in the school and in life and well-liked by the students as well.
Aww.
So during her senior year, which would have been 1978, Carol and a boy named Randy Springer were elected Mr. and Mrs. Blooming Grove High. In the yearbook, could they kind of note that this honor is based on popularity and, quote, the ability to get along with people. I hope you don't have your heart set on winning that award.
I would not qualify.
Well, I'm not sure if Randy was her boyfriend at the time or if it was just her date, but he was the captain of the football team. And I saw him appear in other pictures in the previous year with a different girl. So maybe he was just like the popular jock or whatever, but maybe they were dating. Maybe they weren't. I don't know. But it does show how popular Carol really was.
Yeah.
So because information on Carol was limited outside of those yearbook blurbs, I can't really tell you where she was at in life in 1981. I do know that she was 21, and I don't know if she ever went to college after graduation, but I do know that she had moved to Irving, Texas, which is near Dallas, and she was working at a Metroplex kind of dress shop clothing store type thing. And I want to venture a guess and say it was called Beals, and that was just based on a yearbook photo that I saw, but do not quote me on that because I cannot confirm or deny it. Just I get the feeling that it was a place called Beals. But okay. Bottom line is she was a normal young woman building a future with her whole life ahead of her. And that brings us back to the time of the case. And what we do know about Carol is that she had come back to Blooming Grove that August weekend to visit her mom. Instead, it became the last weekend of her life.
Do we know how far Irving was to her home, to Blooming Grove?
Hour and 14 minutes.
Okay, got it.
Well, as investigators processed this scene on that dirt road, I wish I had more information on what led them to this kind of first milestone that I want to talk about, but somehow they were able to start piecing together Carol's final hours. However they learn this, they figure out that Carol was last seen on Saturday night, which would have been August 29th, sometime between 10:30 and 11 p.m. So she had stopped at a 7-Eleven store at 1451 West 2nd Avenue in Corsicana, and she bought a drink and then had a brief, friendly conversation with a couple who was also waiting at the register. You know, like you're standing in line, you just chit-chat with the people behind you or whatever. That's what happened.
So she's out late. It's a Saturday night. She stops at the convenience store. Was she by herself? And also, I'm assuming there were no security cameras in 1981.
I don't know, because how else would they learn this? I'm speculating, again, based on very limited research. On my end, very limited reporting, I should say. So I don't know, but somehow they figure out she was at this. It could have been a receipt. It could have been, no. 81 was different. You didn't have digital trails.
But she was alone.
She was alone. Yes, that we know.
Okay.
This is interesting because this little conversation that I just mentioned offhand seems to be a big turning point in the case, at least as far as articles go. So the clerk on duty that night had told Sheriff Frost that she didn't hear what Carol and the couple behind her was talking about, but the man had. So Carol like checks out, and then the man in the couple says to his counterpart, says to his like girlfriend, whoever, I wonder what she meant by that. And unfortunately, despite extensive efforts, investigators were never able to track down that couple to find out what Carol had said. Maybe Carol had fears.
Oh, that's so frustrating. Why does this always happen in these cases? Like someone's like, oh, I have to tell you something. I'll tell you later. And then you think back later and you're like, what the hell did that mean?
Well, hindsight's 20/20. So, I mean, at the time, you don't think much of these things until something bad happens. And it's like every little nugget of something that you remember is in play.
They could have had crucial information about like her state of mind that night, or maybe she mentioned where she was going or if she was meeting someone.
But why didn't they come forward then? So they never do come forward. We never know.
It's a convenience store. I mean, maybe they were on a road trip and they never went back to Corsicana, Texas.
We do know that Carol was driving her 1978 Ford Thunderbird that night, and that after she left 7-Eleven, something bad happened. Something between late Saturday night and early Sunday morning. She was abducted, she was sexually assaulted, and brutally murdered. And her car was found eventually about 3 miles east of where her body was discovered. and it was abandoned with the keys still in the ignition.
So we're thinking that the killer drove her car after killing her and then abandoned it, which I feel like that's really brazen. And
yeah.
Also super sloppy, because like you'd think they'd worry about leaving evidence behind. Although I guess maybe they weren't thinking, except for like fingerprints.
Yeah. And I mean, you got to remember what year we're in. I mean, 1981, criminals weren't exactly binging CSI on Netflix, you know?
Right.
So deputies search the Thunderbird and they do find several items of interest. And most notably is this black fishnet style hairnet that's on the left side of the driver's seat. And this hairnet clearly didn't belong to Carol, so it was sent to the Southwestern Institute of Forensic Sciences in Dallas for analysis, along with some hair samples that were, like, in the net.
Do you mean, like, the kind of hairnet you wear if you're in food service?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that's a unique piece of evidence. I don't feel like I've ever heard of a case where a hairnet was a clue.
I know, right? It's new for me, too. Well, Sheriff Ross, he recognized right away that this could be crucial because this now stands out as your like golden piece of evidence. Whoever owns his hairnet likely had something to do with this.
Yeah. Wow.
So the sheriff actually told reporters at the time, quote, "The net is something we can't account for at this time, other than it possibly belonged to the person who drove her car last. We don't believe it belonged to Carol," end quote. And they also find a partially smoked joint in the car.
Oh my God, if this was like nowadays, that would be gold for DNA right. analysis.
Right, exactly, right. Yeah, I didn't tell you that to be like, oh, she had pot in the car. Everybody had pot in their car.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, this is the early 80s, so DNA profiling wouldn't be used in a criminal case for another 5 years. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't become widely available in the U.S. until the late 80s. So investigators really had to rely on kind of traditional, old school, boots to the ground police work. So the one thing they do have there at their disposal at this time period is that they can test this hair. So they have it for comparison, and it was analyzed, and the samples were preserved for future comparison against any suspects that may emerge down the road. So they had that in their back pocket. So as much as we at Murder Unscripted like to speak up when we see shoddy police work, we also like to call out police when they do go the extra mile. I got the impression that that was absolutely the case here with the Navarro County Sheriff's Office. So,
okay.
Yeah. So Sheriff Ross and his deputies, they went hard on this case. They checked every possible lead. They questioned dozens of potential suspects and even reached out to other jurisdictions about similar crimes, which, as we know, was not as easy as blasting out an email like it is today. Like, I would assume they would have used the teletype system, which ironically is like a prehistoric email system.
It was like those machines that would print messages on paper over dedicated phone lines. Does that make sense?
So don't quote me, but I believe it was also tied to the NCIC, and like that's where the teletype terminals were linked. So that's how all these agencies would be connected together. But it was a tedious process, but it did lead Sheriff Ross to speak with detectives in Ector County about a similar incident that occurred in Odessa, Texas, on Saturday, August 23rd, which would have been about a week before Carol's murder. And I looked this up because I was curious how close Odessa is to Corsicana, and it's like 5.5 hours by car. So again, this is gets into the gray area of the case. Like, I'm not entirely sure how they made the connection to that other crime that were like, quote, similar.
Yeah, that seems really far away, but I guess something must have told them that there might be a pattern of some kind. Like,
yeah,
maybe and I have to say, I'm really impressed that they did reach out, because how many times have we seen these crimes happen and police departments like right next to each other don't communicate. So they don't even know that they might have, maybe like we do in this case, a possible serial offender.
Right. And they're reaching out to somebody 5 hours away. So there must have been some kind of link or connection that caused that outreach. But again, I'm telling you literally every detail that I have reported on the case, like everything I'm mentioning, I'm not leaving anything out. This is all I know. So around this time, Carol's autopsy is performed, and the only thing we really know based on her death certificate is that her cause of death was multiple stab wounds to the head, chest, and hands. And again, as I mentioned earlier, I kind of revealed it earlier, 45 stab wounds.
That's insane. And I feel like if she had stab wounds on her hands, those are definitely defensive wounds. And given that she seemed to be very athletic by all the sports and stuff she was into at school, I would assume that she fought like hell to defend herself against this attacker.
I would have thought so. And maybe that's why there's 45 stab wounds. Maybe he would have stopped if she was a lesser victim. He would have stopped at 5 or 6. But because she was fighting, it was frantic. I don't know. But The next kind of milestone in the case is Tuesday, September 1st, when a very short blurb is mentioned that Carol is laid to rest at Rose Hill Cemetery in Blooming Grove, and that's the town where she grew up and the town that had always been home in her heart. But again, no info on the funeral, no pictures, like nothing. Because I imagine it would have been packed with kids from her old high school. Like, this wouldn't have been that long after she was out of high school. And if she was that popular, like, I mean, that the line would have been around the block. So I cannot believe this got no coverage whatsoever.
Wow. I don't get it.
Yeah, it's strange. Well, by late September, Sheriff Ross had sent a 25-page synopsis of the case to the FBI's Behavioral Science Department in Quantico, Virginia. They were very forward-thinking at the time because this unit was very new in 81. And it tells me that either A, they were taking this case very seriously, or B, behavioral studies were like the shiny new toy that they wanted to try out, and this was like a good case for it. And I agree. I mean, this is sadistic as it gets. You got this popular young woman found on some dirt road like a piece of trash. And what better case for the FBI to kind of take a crack at?
Yeah. Wow.
It could also have been a combination of A or B. Like, it could have been all of these things rolled into one. Like, they just didn't know. So a criminologist at the Bureau, he receives a copy of this case synopsis and gets to work compiling a psychological profile on the type of person that would have committed such a violent act. And this included personal characteristics, personal background, criminal background, and behavioral mannerisms that this person could exhibit. So meanwhile, the Corsicana Crime Prevention Council, they got involved too. And initially they had offered a $5,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of Carol's killer. And when that didn't generate any solid leads, they doubled it to $10,000. And that was a significant amount of money in 1981. And I didn't actually look it up, but I meant to, but like, I wonder what that equals in 2025 money.
Hold on, I'm looking. So $5,000 in 1981, holy shit, would be like $35,000 today.
Wow.
That's a lot of money, especially for like a small town like reward.
Yeah, it is. Wow.
Wow.
So a few more tips do roll in, but nothing pans out. So because it was the 80s, police tried the latest investigative craze, hypnosis. And they had tried it on a potential witness first. So this was a Corsicana man who thought he might have seen a vehicle in the vicinity of where Carol's Thunderbird was found. And on September 24th, 1981, so this is about a month after the murder, he agreed to be hypnotized to try and remember any additional details. Like, what could they pry out of him that maybe his subconscious remembered and he didn't? So he was hypnotized by a Department of Public Safety officer from Waco and reportedly remembered, quote, several pieces of useful information about the vehicle. End quote. But interestingly, Sheriff Ross declined to release the details like in the article I read because he thought it would jeopardize the investigation, which I get to an extent.
I would love to know if that Department of Public Safety officer was like qualified to do hypnosis.
Yeah, I don't know.
What like procedures, if he followed policies, like I feel like that would be very easy to lead someone in the direction. Like, kind of like what we talked about with Gil. Like, you don't want to lead right. The witness by saying the color or something like that to make them be like, yeah, it totally was blue.
Right. Sorry, our listeners are going to go nuts because I wish I had follow-up information to be like, well, this is what actually happened. But the articles just stop. And I feel good that we're bringing this story to light a little bit because I was blown away again. Mm. So I mentioned earlier, police did have a couple suspects along the way, and let's talk about a few of them. And when I say talk about, I mean pass along the very limited information that I was able to dig up. So in one of the articles I read from October of 1981, so now this is a few weeks or so since the discovery of Carol's body in her car, investigators administered a polygraph test to a potential suspect, but according to Sheriff Ross, the results led to that man being dismissed as a suspect. How is that for breaking news information?
Well, I mean, I guess we got the basics. Police gave a polygraph to a suspect.
Noted. Perfect. It does seem that they were really keeping this information close to their vests in this one. So we'll see if, as the story goes along, if that hurts or helps. So the one thing that is mentioned in the article is that Sheriff Ross does reach out to a Texas Ranger named Howard Alfred, who went by Slick. And he was from Athens, and he was called in to assist with the investigation.
Wow, that is quite a name, Slick.
Oh, right. I know. That's a great, like, what a perfect Texas Ranger name. Slick.
It's true.
So another Texas character. Well, I appreciate the fact that he's saying we need help. Like, he's already talked to the FBI. He's already reached out to other departments, and now he's bringing in this ranger. Like, I that's what gave me the impression that they were trying everything.
That's incredibly impressive and commendable, especially in 1981 in a small town.
Right. So we're about 2 weeks out now, and Slick and the deputies do bring in two African-American Navarro County men who, surprise, surprise, they don't name publicly, but they do mention that they collect hair samples from them. And the samples are compared to the sample from the hairnet that was found in her car, but not a match. So when that leads nowhere, Sheriff Ross travels to Dallas to interview another potential suspect who, once again, was not named. But again, nothing panned out. So by mid-October, they had yet another suspect, a 21-year-old Dallas resident who was considered a key link by the Navarro County Sheriff's Office. And apparently this suspect's account of his whereabouts on the night of the murder had been contradicted by a woman who was with him for a portion of that evening. She basically said, he wasn't exactly where he said he was. And this guy's brought in for a polygraph, and holy 1980s Batman, but the article states, quote, Sergeant Brian Dunnigan wasn't sure if the man would take the test because the polygraph operator at the Waco Department of Public Safety had recently had a family emergency, end quote.
What does that even mean? So did he take the polygraph or not?
I mean, I wish I could tell you. I would assume that he passed, because if he didn't, he would have been probably a little looked at a little more heavy handed. So he must not have been him. Well,
I wonder what the family emergency was.
I don't know. But yeah, imagine getting out of a polygraph. Like, oh, sorry, he had to take his kid to soccer.
Oh my God, that's so random. And it's weird that they reported on that.
That's what I'm saying. Like, nothing about the victim being in the FHA or playing volleyball, playing basketball. But hey, we interviewed a guy about the case. Well, let's fast forward to mid-November. So now we're about 3 months since this case broke. And Sheriff Ross finally has received the psychological profile from the FBI. And here's where it gets really interesting, because the profile was prepared by John Douglas, like the John Douglas. Ooh. It was the same FBI agent who at the time he'd recently compiled the profile of the Atlanta child murders that helped identify that monster Wayne Williams.
Wow. JD is like one of the founding fathers of criminal profiling.
He really is.
He's incredible. And he's actually the guy that the character Jack Crawford in Silence of the Lambs is based on.
Very good. That's actually true. I'm glad you said that, because I was going to if you didn't.
Got to it first.
Beat me to it. Well, Ross noted that Douglas's profile in the Atlanta case was literally 100%. So this was his exact quote. 100% accurate in describing the personality and psychological characteristics of Wayne Williams, end quote. That must have been what sparked him to reach out to the FBI, like seeing the success in that case.
Okay.
And here is where I would love to tell you about the profile, the kind of person that police are looking for. But Sheriff Ross had imposed a, quote, blackout on the contents of the profile, but said Douglas had given them suggestions to follow up on.
Do we ever get the contents of the profile?
Not that I've seen. I couldn't even get the girl's freaking picture.
I know. Oh my God, that's frustrating.
Well, what's important is that the police now have this profile in their back pockets. And this is interesting, because this must have come from something that he was told in the profile. But Ross announces to the media that he was, quote, strongly considering the possibility that there were two people involved in Carol's killing, end quote. Hmm. But Ross declined to elaborate again for fear of jeopardizing the investigation.
Two people. That's interesting. Like, I wonder what made them think that. But again, I guess we'll never know, because we don't even know what was in the profile.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not even going to go there, because I'm not a profiler. You know, it could have something to do with
not.
I'm barely a podcaster, little. I wish we had time to FOIA. They're called Freedom of Information Act, like case files and reports. But like, you guys would get two cases a year by with how long it takes to get these files in. If we were to do it the way we do on crime shows, like sometimes we'll wait months. We'll file a thing. They have 30 days to respond. And that response could be like, got your request, working on it. And then it's just,
yeah,
they have a certain amount of days to get back to you, but it drags. So the only other development I do want to mention is that about a year after this happened, Jack and Maxine, Carol's parents, or Helen, I guess, but she went by Maxine sometimes, her parents, they filed for divorce. And I have the date here. Let me pull it up. It's on my phone. September 21st, 1982. So we're talking, she was murdered in August of 81. So, I mean,
we hear that so much, that the parents of like murdered children, missing children, they just can't keep it together.
We do see this a lot. And I don't know if it's the trauma, that tears you apart or if you're already having trouble. But I can't even imagine what it would be like to go through something like this. I don't blame anybody who splits up after this.
No, I think it becomes a lot. Marriage is hard to begin with.
Right, right. So unfortunately, that is where the case stands until the next development, which isn't really a development at all. It's actually the opposite. So there's an article about this. 2 years pass, and in June of 1983, police announced that Carol's case has gone cold. So despite all of that effort, despite all the suspects, all the tips, no arrest had been made. And then a name surfaces, one that every true crime junkie will know. Henry Lee Lucas.
Womp womp.
What a monster. Talk about monsters. So in June of 83, Lucas was this 46-year-old drifter and former mental patient who'd already been charged with 3 murders in Texas. And he had become the target of investigators from 16 states because he was claiming to have killed about 100 women over the past 8 years. And at the time, Lucas was being held under $1 million bond at the Montague County Jail.
He was a complicated guy for sure.
And yes.
We know that he definitely killed people. Like, that's not a question. But I want to know the actual number because he confessed to hundreds of murders that he couldn't have possibly committed. Like, there's right. no way.
Yeah.
And he kind of became the centerpiece in this bizarre phenomenon where law enforcement agencies from all over the country would bring him into their cold cases and he'd be like, yep, I did it. That was me.
Yeah.
It was just a mess. And I just watched a documentary. It's really weird that we're talking about him. I just watched a documentary on him and Otis Poole.
Mm-hmm.
They are foul.
Yeah.
Like, there's no words to describe them. Oh, by the way, Henry Lee Lucas, major childhood head trauma.
Really? I didn't know.
Horrible. That. Yeah. Like, multiple times, really bad.
Man, I got to get on board the head trauma train. Because
get on it, man. I'm leading the charge.
Well, Navarro County authorities, they begin investigating whether Lucas may be linked to Carol's murder because it was the cool thing to do, to be frank about it. So Sheriff Deputy James Jones said he supplied Texas Rangers in Montague with offense reports concerning Carol's August 1981 stabbing death to try to determine if she might be one of the approximately 100 women that Lucas was claiming to have murdered. And Jones said, quote, "We are going to see if he has been down in this area. We will try to determine if he was in jail or anyone else when Miss Armstrong was stabbed more than 40 times in the chest and neck and dumped on a dirt road west of Corsicana," end quote.
Well, to be fair, though, this case, I feel like it also has the hallmarks of what was being called the I-35 murders at the time.
True.
Those were a string of still unsolved murders of young women along Interstate 35 in Texas and Oklahoma. And I think that was like late 70s and early 80s.
Yeah, I think some of this stemmed from the fact that 20 of these unsolved murders of the young women alongside this interstate, these women had been identified. And there was this workshop in 1980 called the I-35 Homicide Workshop in Georgetown, where investigators were trying to connect the dots between all of these. And to note, Carol's body was found about 25 miles from I-35. So I don't necessarily think that would have been the I-35 corridor, but maybe they expanded their boundaries a little bit given the nature of the case.
I'm glad they were looking.
Right. Me too. And ultimately, Henry Lee Lucas was ruled out as a suspect in Carol's case, and investigators continued to spin their wheels. So let's get into the man of the hour. And this is a guy who becomes a central figure in the case for all the wrong reasons. And his name was Randolph Eugene Arledge, and he went by Randy. So in August of 1981, Randy was 26 years old. He was a father of 2 young children. He had a 7-year-old son and a 4-year-old daughter. And he did have a criminal record, primarily for property crimes, but nothing overly violent. And on the weekend that Carol Armstrong was murdered, Randy happened to be in Corsicana visiting family.
Oh, boy. I can see this isn't going anywhere good.
Yes. Well, Randy's sister would later testify that he was at a party at her home on the night of August 29th, which, remember, was the night Carol was killed, and that he slept there that night. But she also mentioned that there was a fight at the party, and Randy had gotten into a couple scuffles with some partygoers, and others that were at the party confirmed that he had been in these fights and that he had a knife.
Ooh.
And some testified that he left the party and didn't stay overnight. So needless to say, we have kind of conflicting accounts at this point.
Yeah, I feel like that is definitely not an airtight alibi, especially if others at the party are contradicting what his sister said.
Right, right. Well, so the next day, August 30th, that's the day her body was discovered. Randy had left Corsicana and headed back to Houston where he lived. So about a week and a half later, on September 8th, he meets up with two people who would later seal his fate, Benny Lamas and Paula Lucas. So the three of them, they take off in this stolen van on a road trip that would take them across state lines. So the trio, they were eventually arrested in Cleveland, Tennessee in connection with an armed robbery, and they were all facing serious prison time. And this is where the story takes a dark turn, which would destroy Randy's life for the next three decades. Mm-hmm. So while sitting in a Tennessee prison awaiting sentencing for this robbery, Benny Lamas and Paula Lucas, they apparently had a conversation. And at some point, they contact authorities and tell them that Randy Arledge had confessed to murdering a woman in Corsicana, Texas. And in this small little town, there's really only one person that it could be. Carol Armstrong.
Hold on. So 2 years, this is 2 years after the murder.
It is.
That these two people, like the co-defendants, I guess, in a completely different crime, suddenly decide that they remember that he confessed to this murder. I feel like that's really random and really suspicious timing.
Very fishy, right? Well, according to their testimony, they had met up with Randy in Houston on September 8th, so more than a week after the murder, and he allegedly told him that he had stabbed a girl in Corsicana. And Lamas claimed Randy had blood on his shirt and a bloody knife in his pocket, and he also testifies that he saw a bite mark on Randy's forehead, supposedly from a fight with a victim. That's the story.
All right, hold on. So they're saying that a week after he supposedly murdered Carol, he still has a visible bite mark and like blood on his clothes. I feel like that doesn't add up.
Kind of strange, right? Well, that's because Lamas and Lucas had every incentive to lie. So in exchange for their testimony against Randy, they did both receive favorable treatment from Tennessee authorities. And in fact, Paula Lucas got probation instead of prison time. So just this story, what a hell of a deal, right? Like someone facing armed robbery charges.
Yeah. Well, and that's exactly what we were just talking about in our intro, like informant testimony.
Right.
Especially from people who have something to gain is one of the leading causes of wrongful convictions. They aren't reliable witnesses. Like they're people who are going to say whatever they need to say to help themselves. I don't understand how that's so hard to understand.
But if we talk to Rob Bednar, talk to Kurt Mayle, talk to Steve Peelan, talk to any of the detectives that I know personally, I mean, they will tell you that they take these confessions with a grain of salt sometimes.
Yeah. But
in the 80s, when you're trying to solve a murder that nothing's breaking loose, it seems awfully enticing. Well, normally here is where I would celebrate this confession, that it broke the case wide open and justice for everyone involved. But in this instance, I'm sad to say that based on this testimony, Randy Arledge was indicted for the murder of Carol Armstrong. And he goes to trial in March of 1984, nearly 3 years after Carol's death. And here's what the prosecution had against Randy. He's got the testimony of two convicted felons who got sweet deals in exchange for testifying. And that's it. There, that's the end of the that's the end of the list. So the prosecution basically claimed that a hunting knife that Randy had on him at the time of the Tennessee robbery was identical in shape and size to the weapon used to kill Carol, which is interesting because they never found the knife. How are they determining this? Just based on the wound size, I guess?
Yeah, there's no physical evidence tying him to the crime, right? Like there's no fingerprints, there's nothing from the hairnet, nothing in the car.
Right, and there was no blood evidence on the knife, like no DNA, no nothing that actually connected that to Carol other than like she was stabbed 40 some times with a knife that could be that size. Oh, and remember, he had alibi witnesses like his sister and others at the party who testified that he was with them. So, and I know that there were like differing reports, but one of those accounts says, yes, he was here the whole time. But regardless, the jury believed Lamas and Lucas, and on March 27th, 1984, Randolph Arledge was found guilty of murder.
That's unbelievable. Like, a murder conviction based almost entirely on the word of two people who had not only every reason to lie, but they're clearly degenerate armed robbery losers. Like, why are we listening to them?
They're leaning on his broken criminal record. They're saying this guy was trouble. He was in town. Oh, and he had a big knife and he said he did it. But I could say you did it. I could just go to the cops right now and be like, I was with Melissa last weekend. There was a crime in whatever town. That's literally how they convicted this guy. Like, welcome to America. Well, ultimately, the jury sentences him to 99 years in prison. At the time, Randy was 29 years old. So his daughter was 4 and his son was 7. Like, that meant just what we were talking about. He would miss their entire childhoods, their graduation, their wedding, any kids that they would have, he would miss everything.
That's all really, really sad. But I also feel like there's another big problem. Carol's real killer is still out there. Just walking around, potentially committing other horrific crimes that we didn't take him off the streets.
It's interesting you say that, and I'm going to come back to that in just a hot minute. So Randy begins serving his sentence, which, remember, was set to include time in both Tennessee for that armed robbery and then in Texas for the murder.
Mm-hmm.
So the years tick by, 1985, 1990, 1995, and the world is just passing Randy by as he's just sitting in prison, rotting away. His children are growing up without him. DNA technology is changing.
Mm-hmm.
And all the while, Randy remains behind bars, just maintaining his innocence, pleading for someone to help him. And then in 1998, Randy was paroled on the Tennessee robbery charge and was immediately transferred to the Texas Department of Corrections to continue serving that concurrent sentence for the murder in Texas. So he came up for parole multiple times on this Texas conviction, and his daughter would later say, quote, "Every time he came up for parole, it was broken, shattered hopes," end quote.
And I'm guessing because he wouldn't admit to the crime, they weren't going to parole him. Because you know the parole boards, they want to see like remorse and that you accepted responsibility. But at the same time, you can't show remorse if you're not sorry because you didn't do it.
It's like admit to a crime that you didn't commit just to get out of prison or maintain your innocence and stay locked up. Well, Randy chose the latter. He chose to maintain his innocence. And finally, in 2006, so after more than 20 years in prison, the Innocence Project in New York gets a hold of Randy's case. And Melissa, for those who are new to the genre, would you like to tell our listeners what the Innocence Project is? We mentioned it a couple times already.
I would love to. So the Innocence Project was founded in 1992. By two gentlemen named Barry Scheck and Peter Newfield. And they had the mission of exonerating wrongfully convicted people through DNA testing.
Mm-hmm.
And the Innocence Project has been absolutely instrumental in overturning hundreds of wrongful convictions. And just a note, Barry Scheck is the same attorney who was on O.J. Simpson's defense team.
Yep.
He was the one that raised all those questions about like the DNA evidence handling.
Yep, he's the one and only. So whatever you think of the OJ case, that man knows DNA evidence. And so does the Innocence Project. They locate the physical evidence from Carol's case, which included that hairnet that was found along with those hair samples. And remember, Texas notoriously has one of the best evidence preservation laws in the country, which meant that evidence from a crime that occurred more than 30 years ago was still available for testing, which is pretty wild when you think about it.
Thank God for that. Like, how many cases can't be revisited and retested because the evidence was lost or destroyed or contaminated
properly.
Well,
because again, you're going back to a time when people didn't know what they didn't know, if that makes sense. So
right.
Like you're like, for example, storing evidence, like storing forensic evidence in a plastic bag is a no-no. People who didn't do it on purpose, they just didn't know what the future held.
Right. Well, and look at all the things that happened. The evidence room burns down. There's a flood. All these things. Somebody mislabels a box. Simply mislabeling a box can be the hugest deal ever.
It certainly can. Yeah, well, with the cooperation of the Navarro County District Attorney's Office, DNA testing was conducted by Cellmark Forensics, which we talked about was Orchid Cellmark for a while, in 2011. Mm-hmm. And they test these hair samples from the hairnet and washings from the victim's pubic hair. And here's what they found. Every single item of evidence excluded Randolph Arledge. Like his DNA was nowhere to be found. Not just.
It's horrible.
It's horrible. And this guy's in jail.
Oh my God.
Well, that's not all. So Texas is one of only 9 states that guarantees defendants access to search the CODIS database, which for the newbies, combined DNA index system. And it's basically the FBI's national DNA database. But when they run this DNA profile from the hairnet through CODIS, they get a hit. And it's a match to a convicted felon named David Sims.
Hmm.
And who is David Sims? This is an interesting development, and you're going to see why in a minute. So David Sims was a Navarro County resident with an extensive criminal record that also included aggravated robbery in Navarro County, where he beat a gas station clerk with a giant stick, and another robbery at a gas station, as well as the burglary of a resident, somebody's house. When police confront Sims with the DNA evidence linking him to that hairnet found in Carol's car, he does actually open up a little bit about his life at the time. So Sims admits that in 1981, he had worked at a Long John Silver's restaurant near where Carol was last seen alive. and he would typically get off work around 10 or 11 p.m. wearing a hairnet, just like the one found in the car. And if you recall, 10:30 and 11 p.m. is the same timing where Carol was last seen alive at the 7-Eleven the night she disappeared.
Right.
So I did some digging to see what landed Sims in the system to begin with, and here's what I found. So 4 years after 4 years after Carol's murder, so we're talking 1985, Sims stabs a woman over 90 times, 90,
wow,
when she answered the door to an apartment and told Sims that the person he was looking for wasn't home. So think about that. He goes up and is like, hey, I'm looking for Jerry. I'm just making up a name. And she says, Jerry's not here. And he stabs her 90 times. What kind of unhinged
that
crime?
Makes me think of like The Strangers or whatever that movie was.
Yeah, exactly. Ugh. Like The Strangers.
Now I'm not going to sleep tonight.
I know, right? And I got that information from records obtained from the Dallas County District Attorney's Office. So in the eyes of police, the Dallas County attack was consistent with the overkill stabbing of Carol Armstrong. But you ready for this? The woman in that attack who was stabbed 90 times, she survives. So Sims pleads no contest to attempted murder in the end.
How do you survive that? That's incredible.
I don't know. Well, fortunately, by 2011, police knew how important it was to have everything buttoned up, which meant additional testing was done on the pubic hair comings from Carol's body. And those two yielded a partial male DNA profile consistent with David Sims. So now we have multiple pieces of evidence all pointing back to the same man. So finally, a major development.
So just think about that. Like the overkill stabbing of Carol Armstrong with 45 stab wounds. And then 4 years later, we kind of have the same pattern.
Right.
But this woman stabbed over 90 times. That's like his,
yeah,
it's like his signature.
And all of this was going on while an innocent man sat in prison.
Oh.
Like, isn't that nuts?
Awful. And I think anyone who has listened to us in the past, they know that I especially don't hold back when it comes to the American justice system. And like, this shit is why.
Yeah. And you're not just blowing smoke. Like, I think people might think that sometimes, but like, I hope people see that. Like, this is the reason. How many cases do we cover where you're seeing it unfold?
Oh my goodness.
Well, Barry Scheck said it perfectly when Randy was released, because he was eventually released from prison. They were like, ooh, yeah, sorry. To send him on his way. So he said, quote, unfortunately, this is yet another case where a witness who got a deal gave false testimony that led to the conviction of an innocent man. And based on DNA testing, there is good reason to believe the man who really committed the 1981 murder went on to commit several other terrible crimes while Mr. Arledge was incarcerated, end quote. And there's one more piece to this puzzle. So remember Benny Lamas, the informant whose testimony helped convict Randy in the first place? So years later, Lamas admitted that he lied. He said that. He recanted his testimony, saying that he made up the story about Randy confessing because of a personal dispute, meaning like he was being a petty bitch about something and fabricated this whole thing. And this guy ends up getting locked up for decades.
Yeah, this wasn't just like a little harmless white lie. Like a man lost 30 years of his life in prison because this douchebag got his like panties in a wad.
That's exactly what happened. And get this. So Lamas wasn't done revealing like disturbing information. He said that before Randy's trial, he was in the same cell with Paula Lucas. And she, quote, agreed to testify that Randy had admitted killing the girl as well, end quote.
So they were working together to like coordinate their lies.
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes me so angry. Like two people knowingly sent this innocent man to prison for nearly 30 years, destroying his relationship with his children, stealing decades of his life. And it was also that they could get a better deal on their own charges.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's evil. Like that's genuinely evil.
It's as evil as it gets. It really is, because it's as selfish as it gets, we can say. Well, let's get to the happy ending. So on happy-ish ending. So on February 11th, 2013, Randy Arledge walks into a courtroom in Corsicana wearing shackles around his wrists and ankles, like a murderous monster. And he was 58 years old at the time, meaning he had spent half his life behind bars for a crime he did not commit. And with the concurrence of Navarro County District Attorney Lowell Thompson, Judge James Lago Marcino agreed to release Randy on bond while the process of overturning his conviction was pending. Because I assume there's some paperwork that goes in.
I would think so. Yeah. Well, you got to give credit to the DA for doing the right thing here. Not every prosecutor would do it.
I agree with that. Yeah, well, the two deputies who took Randy, they take him back to his room and remove his shackles. And when he comes back out, the first thing he does is he hugs his two children. Children who had been 4 and 7 when he went to prison, they're now grown-ass adults. Like, I would be like, who are you? Who am I hugging? Like, yeah. You don't even recognize him. But I imagine they supported his innocence, maybe, and visited him in prison. So I don't know. I don't know that side of the story.
Yeah.
But after the hearing, Randy did speak to reporters, and he gestured to his daughter, Randa Michelle Arledge, and said, quote, "She was always talking about how she wanted me to come pick her up from school. Now she's picking me up," end quote.
Oh, that's so heartbreaking. And not only like did they miss out on all those moments together, but I wonder what that did to the kids. We know that other kids are assholes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they probably got teased that their dad was in prison.
Guarantee like, it, because they were so young.
Murderer. What?
Yep.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, on May 3rd, 2013, Randolph Arledge was officially exonerated by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, which meant the charges against him were considered dismissed. They didn't even exist. So he became the 118th person in Texas to have their conviction overturned. And he had more than 30 years behind bars, 14 of them specifically for Carol's murder. Because remember, the armed robbery in Tennessee. So we're counting that too.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about where we are now. So Texas has one of the most generous compensation laws in the country for exonerees. And the state will provide a lump sum payment of $80,000 for each year that somebody was wrongfully behind bars, plus an annuity and some other benefits. So given the complexity of Randy's case, like with time served in both Tennessee and Texas, it's unclear exactly how much compensation he received, but he was entitled to a significant amount of support to rebuild his life. And there is no price. I don't think there's a price that's too high. Pay that man.
No, I don't think any amount of money can give you back 30 years.
No.
I mean, it's good that Texas recognizes that the state owes something to the people it wrongfully imprisons.
Right.
I think a lot of states, I don't think many states have any compensation at all. I mean, it's sad we even have to have a law for that. Like, that shouldn't happen in the first place to need a law.
Exactly. Well, after his release, Randy went on to live with his children while he got back on his feet. And from what we can find, he's been working on rebuilding his relationship with his family and trying to live whatever normal life he can muster after, like, such a profound injustice.
What happened with David Sims? Was he charged with Carol's murder?
Don't even get me started. So this infuriates me because I wasn't expecting this. I was not expecting to read what you're going to hear. So according to the Innocent Project's page, at the time of Randy's exoneration, David Sims was, quote, "the subject of a criminal investigation relating to the Armstrong murder," end quote. However, that is where the trail ends in 2013. And
what the hell?
I was unable to find any public records indicating that Sims was ever formally charged with Carol's murder. What? You got his DNA all over the place and not enough to charge him?
Yeah. Like, so where is he right now?
Well, so I found a court doc that mentioned David Len Sims, L-E-N, was convicted in 2017 and sentenced to 82 years in prison. However, it's not for what you think. So this court record I found outlined that on May 18th, 2016, which meant as of 2016, he was still out doing whatever he was doing.
Ugh.
A woman named Kaylin Corner was working at the Tiger Tote convenience store in Corsicana, Texas, when a man entered the store and pointed a gun at her. The man demanded Corner turn over all the money in the register. And she was said that he was wearing white gloves, a dark baseball cap, dark clothing, and dark shoes. So Cormer gives him the money, and the man instructs her to get into the store's cooler. And then from the cooler, like there's a window in it, she can see him basically taking a bunch of lottery tickets too.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then he instructs her to lay down on the floor of the cooler once he like saw her, and the man leaves the store with all this cash and a handful of lottery tickets.
Wow.
And this was like a streak of... Like, check this out. So on his record also, these are the things he was charged with. These are the places he robbed, I should say. The Shell station in the 1950 block of MLK Boulevard was robbed around 9:30 p.m. on Wednesday, May 18th. The Shell station on the 2800 block of 2nd Avenue was robbed at gunpoint around 9:40 p.m. Sunday, May 15th. The Valero gas station on the 2500 block of 7th Avenue was robbed at gunpoint around 1 a.m. Monday, May 9th. And the Chevron station at the 2800 block of West 7th Avenue was also robbed at gunpoint around 10:30 p.m. Tuesday, May 11th. So in what, a week's time, he robbed four gas stations in addition to the 18th, we're at the Tiger Toad convenience store.
That's insane. I would like to pull up all his addresses and see how close together they all are.
I bet you're really close.
I'm going to look it up. But does that mean that Carol's case might technically still be open if this guy was never charged? I'm confused.
I hate to say that, but that's where the story ended that I could find. I swear to God, if anyone out there, like Shannon too, if anybody can find information that this is anything more than what we're looking at, like if David Sims is arrested for this crime, I haven't seen it. And like, yes, an innocent man was freed, and that's a win. I mean, if we're being honest, but Carol Elaine Armstrong still doesn't have the justice that she deserves. Like, her family spent over 30 years believing her killer was in prison and then learned he wasn't, that the real killer was still out there, and as far as we know, has never been held accountable for the awful things that he did to Carol.
And then to add insult to injury, the justice system bailed her not once, but twice. First, by convicting the wrong man, and second, by apparently letting the real killer escape accountability.
I don't know what happened. I would love to talk to someone about this and be like, what happened? You had his DNA.
Yeah, where is he? What is going on? I feel like these exoneration stories are often like spun as like these triumphs, and they are, don't get me wrong, but I feel like sometimes people forget that there's still a victim here. Like, it's like we forget about them, that they still deserve justice.
Yeah, and because the exoneration is the story. But in reality, someone was murdered, and that person often gets lost in all this media attention.
Do we know what happened to Benny and Paula?
I don't. I didn't look it up. I didn't care.
I hope they both suffered. Like, yeah. I'm not sorry, but they're assholes.
Yeah, I hope they think every day about how they ruined somebody's life.
I hope something horrible happens to them each and every day. They are scum.
Well, if anybody out there has any information about the murder of Carol Elaine Armstrong, please contact the Navarro County Sheriff's Office. I'll put their number up on screen for a listening audience. It's 903-654-3001. And like, even after all these years, tips can make a difference because DNA technology continues to improve. Witnesses who are afraid to come forward, like maybe ready to talk now. And Carol's family deserves closure. I'm not sure how many people are left in her family. I do know that a lot of people have passed away, but I was interested to see that in these articles updating, like when Arledge was freed, there was no comment from Carol's family.
Yeah, that's always interesting. And I think that sometimes the family gets upset and they think that maybe it's wrong. I think sometimes they just want someone to blame.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not right, but I can understand where they're coming from.
I think it might be worth reaching out to them, not to participate in anything, but just ask them, be like, what happened? Like, you get word that this guy's DNA matches, and then just poof, he's back robbing convenience stores years later. Like, what? Why wasn't he in jail for this?
Yeah, we need to look into that.
Well, that's the case, guys. Just a wild story that I really was excited, despite the lack of information, to bring you, because what happened here?
Yeah, and if anyone knows anything about Carol Elaine Armstrong, please tell us. I want to know more.
Yeah, I'd love to know more. Do you have any, being the first case of the new year, I feel like there should be expectations set for what Melissa wants to be this year? You're like unemployed on an island somewhere?
Oh, on Dog Island.
Yes.
Just me and a bunch of dogs. That's literally my dream. No humans.
Do you have any resolutions?
No, dude. Just get up and live. Like,
wow.
I don't think that you should put that much pressure on yourself. I think if you're surviving, that is enough for some people.
It's not. You're not wrong there. I feel like a lot of people set these goals and then it's because I think everyone's off for the holidays and feeling themselves like, you know what, I could do. You're in good. Then you get back to work. It's like, I just want to make it through the day.
Yeah, it's like new year, new me. And then it's like, no, it's the same old me.
New year, old me. Same me.
Exactly.
I agree. Well, I started last year. I'm just going to continue a resolution that I started last year. When I have the opportunity to do things with somebody, I'm going to do it. Like before, I feel like I would kind of push it off and be like, do I really like feel like doing that? And sometimes like it's not the most convenient thing to do, but this show has taught us nothing else. It's that how fragile life is and how things can change on a dime.
It's so important.
I know. So I'm just going to try to be better about like doing things with people when the opportunity comes up.
I guess my only resolution, if I had to pick one, is to spend more time with my dogs and do more things
with them.
That's
not possible.
To like make them happy is like the only thing that I care about, honestly.
Well, as long as you have goals.
Exactly. Well, I guess with that, that is it. We will be back next week. Please remember to review, rate, subscribe. Oh, and before we forget, our Patreon just dropped. So as of right now, depending on what tier you're in, there are two episodes available, a regular full-length episode and a mini, which is like a 25 to 30-minute episode. Yep. So you can head on over to Patreon and check that out. We have a link on our website.
Yeah, check it out. Good stuff. A more personal version of us. A more relaxed, a little loose.
Definitely
with our language.
More relaxed. Oh, yeah. 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 I mean, when we recorded it, I was like literally like half lying on the couch, half falling.
Yeah, you had like
couch.
One leg on the table. Like,
I know.
Microphone in your hand.
Yeah. Ed and I recorded that together. So that was felt like in person. Yeah.
That's going to be the difference, is we're going to try to record those always in person because we don't need to set up a studio because you're just hearing it. This is for the audio only people.
Yeah, exactly. So get excited for that. If nothing else, that should be entertaining.
True.
But until next week, we hope that you stay safe. We hope that you stay hydrated. And most importantly, we hope that you remember perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
I don't even know who to call a pervert in this case. Like, I feel like whoever did this to Carol Armstrong is the pervert to the highest degree. But was that David Sims? I don't know.
Well, I do know that Benny and Paula can suck it. I'm so angry with them.
Yeah.
Bye.